You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also chat with us on Twitter by going to twitter.com/thetakeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Cool, clear water, chasing it, collecting it, distributing it safely. It's a long, dramatic narrative in American history. We'll take a swim this hour. But first, let's hear from our good friend, Jack.
Jack is dead, my friend. You can call me Joker.
Jack Nicholson is the evil Joker. You may recall in the Batman comics, the Joker was continually threatening the water supply in Gotham City. So evil. Later this hour, the challenge of coming up with bad guys for Hollywood in the age of movie globalization. Also, that new presidential directive on regulating the collection of electronic intelligence data by the NSA. New Yorker staff writer Lawrence Wright says that the Edward Snowden revelations, if anything, strengthen the argument that the NSA has still yet to show us its work has actually prevented terrorist attacks. We conclude on a benign internet note. Scientists hip to the powers of crowdsourcing gather funding and helpers online when federal help is declining. But first, we're asking the question, how's your water? San Mateo, California. My water is fantastic, you write. I worry more about the pipes in my house than the hundreds of miles of aqueduct getting it to Oakland.
This is McKenna Brown from Harrisburg, Oregon. My hometown water tastes like you're licking pennies, and it corrodes all of our appliances. It leaves hard water deposits. It makes your hair all grimy. So we never drink it, and we try not to use it when possible.
McKenna, sounds like a high mineral content there in Oregon. People of West Virginia spend very little time until this week worrying about their own abundant supplies of fresh mountain water. Now, the consequences of that chemical spill in the Elk River are still being felt in the Charleston area. Jennifer Wiedes is an assistant professor of environmental engineering at West Virginia University. How's your water down in Morgantown?
It's tasting great.
And what are the issues? Are you chlorinated? What kinds of additives are in your water? And what sort of upstream or industrial concerns do you have in Morgantown?
Well, here in Morgantown, we get our water straight from the Monongahela River. And we got a very advanced treatment system on that water coming from the river. So it is chlorinated as it comes to my tap. I'd have to say it tastes pretty much like normal city water. I actually grew up in the country on a groundwater well, which was very mineral tasting. And here in Morgantown, it actually tastes better.
Normal city water. We'll explore what that is and the history of how we got to this notion of normal city water. Jennifer, thanks so much.
No problem.
Mark Davis is director of the Institute on Water Resources, Law, and Policy at Tulane University Law School. So, Mark, what are the issues down in New Orleans?
Well, a lot of our issues are those faced by many cities in the United States, particularly the older ones, and that is you have an aging and crumbling infrastructure. But then we complemented that with having that whole system crushed by Hurricane Katrina. So we're rebuilding much of that right now. And for the first time, we're actually looking at, a more comprehensive approach to managing water, over the broad spectrum. We just released a comprehensive urban water plan, which may give us a better blueprint for going ahead, but there's a long way to go.
And you are downstream in the Mississippi River Basin from basically everyone in North America. I mean, you're getting everything that's thrown in the water upstream.
That's exactly right. And I think it's one of the things you learn is, water management is not just a local issue. And the things that work in one community or in one waterway may not necessarily be the best option in another. So we follow all these things that happen upstream and then try to contend with it when it gets here.
Mark Davis at Tulane University Law School in New Orleans. Thanks so much, Mark.
Pleasure.
David Soule is an assistant professor of the Watershed Institute for Collaborative Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. So, David, how's your water?
The water here is excellent. We're fortunate to live in a place where there's lots of water, very much like New York City where you are.
And are you dealing with river systems, runoff from winter snow melt, those sorts of things? Are the seasonal patterns keeping your water pure? What are the mineral issues?
Yeah, the big issues here in the upper Midwest have to deal with agricultural pollution. It's past summer, the state of Minnesota issued a report stating that about 70% of water pollution in this area is linked to excessive manure and fertilizers. So that's really the big issue. Really, we're upstream of where Mark is, and we're sending down a lot of the pollutants that people in New Orleans are eventually dealing with.
And I'm sure he thanks you for that, Mark Davis does. But David, so are you chlorinated? Are you fluoridated? What sort of deliberate additives do you have in your water there in Eau Claire?
It's a standard urban water system with chlorination. And the main issues, again, are dealing with agricultural pollution that's coming from the surrounding watershed.
So your greatest fear would be to drink water out of the tap and get some waterborne infection or something like that from the agricultural impacts?
Perhaps. I feel pretty confident that the systems that are in place are going to protect people at least most of the time.
Well, a snapshot from three places around the country. David Soul is an assistant professor of the Watershed Institute for Collaborative Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. He's also the author of Empire of Water, an environmental and political history of the New York City water supply. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So water is destiny, water is geography, water is history. Martin Melosi joins us now, author of The Sanitary City, professor of history at the University of Houston. Professor, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
So how did those chemicals get there in the waters of America, the standard urban water system with chlorine and those other additives? And how does that all interact with the kind of industrial problems that have been described in the cities that we visited briefly?
Yeah, well, things have gotten in the water in all kinds of ways, certainly even in pre-industrial times, certainly from mining, as we've learned recently again. From industrial processes, from runoff in urban areas because of development, all those different ways. And, of course, history plays an important role because as the physical infrastructure and nature of our communities change, what goes into our water also changes.
Now, politically, it was very controversial to do chlorination and particularly fluoridation. How did that get resolved? And do we now pretty much take a more passive view about the kinds of additives and deliberate agents that are put in urban water supplies?
Well, it crops up over and over again. The fluoridation issue seems to kind of recur now and then, as does any kind of input of chemicals in the water. But the major reason why it started was that we, in the 19th century, when this really got underway, late 19th century, early 20th century, our sense was that pollution was equatable with biological problems, epidemics, and so forth. So we used the term pollution really to refer to biological problems, and certainly chemicals then were seen as a way of disinfecting the water. Industrial pollution, any kind of chemicals that were inadvertently into the water, really were not always seen as potential pollution problems if the water source that they entered was large and the flow was quick. That's how engineers kind of evaluated the impact of industrial materials in the water. They called, you know, the process of dilution. And in some cases, in the late 19th, even early 20th century, arguments could have been made that chemicals going into the water inadvertently, like phenol, quote-unquote, disinfected the water and actually killed the biological agent. So when chlorine was added, there's this kind of mixed reaction about something not natural going into the water, at the same time the view that it was going to stem the tide of epidemics.
Now, that is a revelation, what you've just said there, that on biological agents, we use chemical remediation to deal with, and I'm thinking of our friend up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, who has to worry about agricultural runoff. So in some sense, we're going back to the days of concerns about biological agents in water. But yet when we deal with industrial pollutants, it's not filtration that we're concerned with, you know, wiping it out or killing it. We're just diluting it. So we actually accept the industrial pollutants more than we accept the biological agents. And in West Virginia, that has proved to be a real problem.
Well, it's not so much we accept them any longer. Certainly that was true earlier in the 20th century. We've come to kind of a different understanding of the complexity of pollution. But when you have industrial agents or anything of that kind coming into the water, what complicates it is the question of economic development. This is always kind of the classic, polarities between, you know, we need jobs versus we need a clean environment. So that issue kind of goes on and on. We didn't really understand biological agents until about the turn of the century when we turned toward bacteriology in the early 20th century, and we began to really understand what caused disease. until that time, all we did was kind of search for what we believed to be clean water sources. And industrial pollution, again, gets kind of caught up in that, in the kind of economic, kind of political battles that take place, aside from the scientific debates.
How rare is the situation in New York City where there's a reservoir system that's far outside of the city, away from industrial contamination and industrial development, even though there is a nuclear plant nearby? How rare is that? And compare it to your situation in Houston, where you're basically a city built on a lot of swampland.
Yeah, well, it is. It was certainly rare when the Croton Aqueduct system was built in New York. One of the things about that system is that they had a relatively pure supply, which they were able to maintain by and large for a long, long time. Houston was built primarily on groundwater until after World War II. Most of our water came from wells. After that time, we went to a surface water system with a water supply north of Houston. So in the broadest sense, we look a lot more like New York would look today. And a lot of other big cities that had the resources moved away from their core in order to get what they believed to be abundant and precious water supply. So it's more common now than it used to be, although cities draw their water from all kinds of places.
Do you trust your water there in Houston? And what's your advice?
Every now and then there's some issues that arise over evaluations of the water supply, but it's been pretty strong. Some of the problems here have to do with a lot of line breakages and sometimes not being able to deliver adequate pressures to houses. There's always a question of monitoring to make sure that the water is safe. And right now we don't have any kind of major debates over that. I mean, people have different views on how they want their water supplied.
Well, we certainly have learned of the vulnerability of all of these supplies, and they are very, very different around the country. Martin Malesi is the author of The Sanitary City, professor of history at the University of Houston. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thank you.
So water stories everywhere. Just up the road from Houston, Dennis is from Fort Worth.
Fort Worth water is pretty good outside of the summer algae blooms. I trust it to be safe. You got to trust something.
In Kansas City, the approach is denial. Our tap water is mediocre, you write, although I try not to think about it. I'm fairly sure I would be disgusted. They have problems in Charleston, West Virginia. Well, the people of Charleston, South Carolina can relate.
Hi, this is Emily from Charleston. Charleston's drinking water? It's like Civil War era pipes. It's horrible. I guess you just gotta love the lead.
Now, we can't take Emily's word that there is tasteable lead in South Carolina water, but what you feel about your water does matter. Some water bliss now from Oahu. We have near-perfect drinking water. No fluoride, which is an issue for some. Thanks for rubbing it in out there in Hawaii. A lot of things we could envy. Tell us what your water tastes like. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Do you trust your water system? Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
When you cut through the noise, what's really at stake is how we remain true to who we are in a world that is remaking itself at dizzying speed.
In a moment, the president raises the issue of where government-collected electronic data should live legally. We'll speak with Todd Zwillick about how much the president can do on his own and how much requires congressional approval. The president's new directive on electronic surveillance asks a lot of questions. It seems to rein in the NSA's vast capabilities revealed in the Edward Snowden archive and tightens the oversight over broad searches and phishing expeditions without a warrant. This preoccupation with oversight of the NSA, though, while important, concerns Lawrence Wright, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Wright says there is a much more basic question behind all of today's proposed reforms, and that is, has the NSA made the case that its data collection has actually made this country more safe from attack?
Well, this is a debate that's been going on since 9/11. You know, do we have the powers? Have we given our intelligence agencies enough power to counter the terrorist threat, or do we need to award them additional powers? Since 9/11, we've awarded the intelligence agencies vast new powers under the Patriot Act and national security letters And it is under the Patriot Act that allows the intelligence agencies to collect tangible things, any tangible things that might be used in a terror investigation. It's a very broad authorization, and the intelligence agencies have taken ample use of it, especially in the case of metadata collection.
Do you think technologically the NSA has rendered the FISA court system and the Church Committee's oversight ideas obsolete?
Well, that was the opinion of one of the judges last month in Washington. He felt that this was really, this metadata collection was so informative. You could learn so much about an individual through tracking his calls, that really was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And then another judge that same month ruled that it was not. And the Supreme Court will finally have to decide that, I'm sure. But there's another question, John, that's underlying this, is whether it's effective. That's something that I don't think that case has been made yet.
In your book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, you make a very compelling case that what was critical in terms of intelligence information that was known about before the attack was the lack of cooperation between agencies. Do you think that problem still exists or has been addressed in any way since 9/11?
Yeah, I do think it still exists, and we have examples of where the failure to communicate between federal agencies has come close to disaster. If you remember the Christmas Day flight of this young Nigerian man whose name was Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab, 2009, his father went to the CIA and told them that his son was a radical Islamist extremist who was in Yemen, and he was afraid that he might be mixed up with Al-Qaeda. This is 8 years after 9/11, and the CIA did not tell the FBI.
And you also make the case that the intercepts of agencies like the NSA provide tantalizing clues to piece together what happened after an attack, but are of questionable value in predicting an attack. In light of the Snowden revelations and the new capabilities of the NSA, do you think the NSA has any better capability to predict, or is it just more noise?
You have to be selective in this. You know, they're trying to store the data for all calls. And if you have the capacity to look at everything, it makes it difficult to know exactly what to look at. If you go back to the 9/11 calls, the judge in New York was trying to make the case in his decision that, and it's based on statements that former FBI Director Robert Mueller has made, former CIA agents have made, or the current NSA head have all said, if we had this metadata collection, we could have stopped 9/11. And yet, they had that capacity. They had the telephone number in Yemen. They were tracking it. They were using it to map out the social network of Al-Qaeda. It was one of the most valuable things that investigators ever had. They could find out who was calling that number. They called it the Al-Qaeda switchboard. And they would know where the person was calling from. And then they would find out who that person was calling for him. And then that way, they were able to map the global network of Al-Qaeda. Now, the FBI thought that it was getting all of the information from the NSA, but it wasn't. The NSA was giving that information to the CIA, and the CIA was keeping it from the knowledge of the FBI investigators. And why they were doing that is an unanswered mystery. They had all the legal authority they needed. They didn't need any extra legal authority to do their job. They just needed to know that Al-Qaeda was in America.
So in thinking about reform of the NSA or responding to the Snowden allegations and the controversies surrounding them, do you think the priority of this administration should be to clarify the legal authority, to push back the discretion of the NSA, or to bolster and fundamentally rethink the whole idea of the FISA court system and the oversight mechanisms?
My personal feeling is that we have to understand that transparency is now the order of the day. WikiLeaks, Edward Snowden, it's going to be very hard to keep secrets anymore in an age where information is so easily passed. I think it's we have to look at a fundamental change and make our intelligence agencies more a part of the process. I think that their notion of overvaluing secrecy has led them to many errors in the past. And if, I think we could have a much intelligence agency if it were more open and more engaged with the public, and rather than trying to secretly collect information on everybody.
And that mission can't be tweaked into existence. It involves a fundamental rethinking of the strategy of intelligence collecting.
I think so. I think that we're at a point where the intelligence agencies, they've been reorganized since 9/11. We've got a whole new bureaucracy, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. We have the National Counterterrorism Center, where these secrets are supposed to be exchanged and not closeted as they were before 9/11. But that's not always the case. So there's no perfect system. We don't want to handicap our intelligence agencies, but we want to make sure that they have checks and balances. And in the case of this complete collection of all calls, tracking everybody, that's not a check and a balance.
Lawrence Wright is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure, John. Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I am therefore ordering a transition that will end the Section 215 bulk metadata program as it currently exists and establish a mechanism that preserves the capabilities we need without the government holding this bulk metadata.
And with that, President Obama takes many of the recommendations of his special review panel on the way the National Security Agency collects intelligence. Metadata collection must go, the president says. He's initiated a transition away from what has been business as usual at the NSA. Are we safer from terrorism? Are we safer from being spied on by our own government? Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Todd?
Hi, John.
Can we answer those questions? The president certainly went beyond what people were saying as recently as 24 hours ago.
That's true, but there's a long way to go in so many of these transitions. We know a couple of things that are going to happen right away, like today in the next 2 months, and then a lot of unanswered questions because it relies on Congress, where there are so many divides between Democrats themselves, between Republicans themselves, and between the parties, so we can't answer a lot of those questions. One thing that we do know that's going to happen right away is that the president is ordering the NSA to dial back when they're searching the metadata, when they're actually going through their bulk collection for a foreign terrorist target, dialing back how many hops, how many steps away from a target they take in terms of phone numbers, how many people that person has communicated with. Now, dialing it back from 3 to 2, not a huge jump, but basically paring back their ability to search.
Let's explore that, though, because the language here was very, very detailed for a speech that was at the Justice Department and really intended for all of Americans to hear. There was a lot of maybe opaque specificity here. Here's one example.
I've ordered that the transition away from the existing program will proceed in 2 steps. Effective immediately, we will only pursue phone calls that are 2 steps removed from a number associated with a terrorist organization instead of the current 3. And I have directed the Attorney General to work with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court so that during this transition period, the database can be queried only after a judicial finding or in the case of a true emergency.
Let's take the last bit first there. Only after a judicial finding, that's sort of like it is now with the FISA court, and only in the case of a true emergency. Now, is that different from what the Bush administration, for instance, talked about as a true emergency? You know what I mean?
This is always the problem with national security and government pronouncements of this kind. What's a true emergency? Isn't that subjective? One guy's emergency is another guy's excuse. So we don't know quite what that means yet, although with all the public scrutiny, maybe we can imagine that a true emergency is a little closer to the definition, John, that maybe you and I would hold and not some intelligence
imminent
official.
Attack, that sort of thing.
Imminent attack or something like that. We don't know exactly what that means, and that's important. Now, judicial finding is ambiguous, too, because judicial finding is not a warrant. A warrant is a warrant. And a lot of people don't want that database queried without a FISA warrant. And this is the difference now between the immediate time when the president says no searching without a judicial finding or a true emergency, and what Congress is going to have to decide between now and the end of March when the authorization for these programs expire, and the lawmakers are going to have to weigh in, which is, do you need a FISA warrant to query the database of these calls? The database isn't going anywhere. Phone companies keep this data. The question is,
it's in the cloud.
It's in the cloud. Where will the data live? Not physically, Nevada or Florida. Where will it live? What servers? What computers? Who will be the gatekeepers? That's the most important thing. Will it be private companies, a third party? Will the government do it? And then what are the rules for accessing it? Is it a warrant, a judicial finding? How often? When can you search?
And
they're saying no more blank warrants.
Will there be an attorney really holding them accountable to some of these details, which also is something Congress would have to rule on? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet.
Need my sister and my daughter.
Rosebud. Funny, like I'm a clown. I amuse you.
You had me at hello.
Oh, it's Movie Friday. Yeah, those are some good clips. We haven't heard those for a while. I love it. Kristen Meinzer is with us, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Rafer and Kristen, welcome.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
So how many Jack Ryans have there been?
I think this is the fourth one.
The fourth,
yeah.
Alec Baldwin was one.
Yeah,
Alec
Ben Baldwin. Affleck, Harrison Ford.
And the latest, can you guess?
These are dangerous people, Kathy. You cannot be here.
If you told me who you really were,
I took an oath. I couldn't tell you unless we were married. Oh, you wouldn't marry
that's
me.
That's why you wanted to marry me? So that you could tell somebody you were in the CIA?
Of course not. You lied
to me for 3 years and you were good at it. I think you actually enjoyed it.
Can we have a minute, please?
No, you can't.
I would like to talk to Jack
Lowe,
please.
This is geopolitics. It's not couples therapy.
Jack Ryan, played by Chris Pine in Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit. What do you think, Rafer?
You know, you've got Chris Pine. He's a young, fresh face. He's from Star Trek. I think they want to freshen it up a little bit. What kind of baffled me about this was how 80s it is. You know, of all the things that are going on in the world, terrorism, the financial crisis, et cetera, they go back to the Russians, and they're like, they're Cold War-style Russians. They say things like, America will bleed.
Hey, no bad Russian accents on this
program.
The executive producer banned them yesterday. Kristen, what do you think of this movie?
You know, full disclosure, I have not actually seen any other movies in the Jack Ryan franchise. So I went in completely blind, and I just saw it as a really fun espionage thriller. I thought Chris Pine was totally likable, and Kevin Costner as his CIA boss I thought was really fun. And who doesn't love Kenneth Branagh, who plays the bad guy?
Branagh's the bad guy.
Yes, he is.
And director.
All right, so a reasonably good recommendation from Rafer. Not from me.
I thought it was reasonably good.
Reasonably, yes. so a B plus and an F. All right, so Ice Cube, a cop, Kevin Hart, also in this movie, Ride Along. Let's listen.
Oh, damn, it's Sir Scream-A-Lot.
That's not. I was responding to a hostile situation, James. I have no shame in that. You call for backup when there's a hostile situation.
I wasn't calling for backup. That was a high-pitched scream. And you pushed my sister in the way.
I pushed your sister out of harm's way.
Kristen, urban cop comedy, urban cop drama. Which is this?
It's a comedy. It takes place in Atlanta. You have Kevin Hart, who is engaged to a young woman he wants to marry but has to pass through the older brother test. And the way to do that is to go on a cop ride-along. The older brother, played by Ice Cube. Along the way, they come into lots of violence and scary stuff, but they might learn to love each other along the way.
We haven't seen Cube in a while.
He was in 21 Jump Street, and soon to be released, the sequel, 22 Jump Street.
Also playing a cop.
You like?
I did not like, which is too bad, because I like Ice Cube, and I like the director, Tim Story, who did Think Like a Man, which I liked a lot. I know Kristen
we
did as well.
We both like that,
This one, bit of a dud, I have to say.
Yeah, it's a shame. They're very likable, but it's just not funny, unfortunately.
Well, as the parent on the Movie Date podcast team, Rafer, you have to see all the animated films. This is Nut Job.
We got to get those nuts before the rest of the park gets in on this. Let's go over the plan. That's us. There's the card. We rob the card and then stuff ourselves silly all winter. Oh, great. We got company.
Nut Job, movie about squirrels. Parent killer or fabulous family entertainment?
Well, I went in with high hopes because I like the idea of squirrels. I like the idea of an animated heist job flick, and I like the idea of squirrels knocking over a nut shop. But unfortunately, this actually becomes almost too much like a heist flick. It gets really bogged down in the details. There are no characters you can really care about. And so even though it's a little better than most animated kids films, there's still something kind of oddly dark and noirish about this that I thought was very strange. So not so great.
Not a great week for Rafer Guzman. Anyway, the three
it's
movies,
January.
Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, Ride Along, and The Nut Job. What's on the podcast this week, Kristen?
We are going to be going over all those Oscar nominations that came out yesterday and share our thoughts on whether we love or hate them or feel anyone's been dissed.
Nebraska? That was kind of a surprise, right?
I was mostly surprised by Gravity tying for the most nominations.
Yeah, you didn't like Gravity. Yeah,
not
so
in a
much.
Good way, right, Kristen?
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, which you can find at thetakeaway.org. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan is back to fighting Russians after a stint fighting IRA bombers, Arab terrorists. Hollywood basically has a problem these days. They want to sell movies everywhere in the world, and they need bad guys that don't offend a billion people here and there. Also, America's changing role in the world may make it hard for some to see U.S. CIA agents as good guys, Tom Clancy notwithstanding. James Furbish joins us now. He's the founder of the Sly Oyster blog and co-author of the essay Hollywood's Evil Men, a symbol of America's collective fears. James, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, John.
So in the 21st century, in an era of globalization and where we really need to, you know, be closer to China and Russia, for that matter, how hard is it to come up with a credible bad guy that's not just an alien or some, you know, robot left over from World War II?
I would say it's enormously difficult. We see this really for the past decade. It's been hard for Hollywood post 9/11 world, having sort of Arab terrorists as the bad guy almost really hits too close to home. We see an absence of Chinese villains, perhaps because they're the, you know, largest untapped foreign box office market for Hollywood. And God forbid they risk having something negative financial ramifications by not having their movie shown in China. And, you know, we really see this reflected in sort of the use of superhero movies time and time again at the box office. These sort of cartoon caricature villains that are, you know, largely nation stateless, if you will.
Right. Yeah. The Joker doesn't come from anywhere in particular.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Heath Ledger's mind, Jack Nicholson's mind, any number of actors' minds. What do you think of this notion of America's collective fears? How do you go about creating a composite that represents that?
You know, you do sort of see some patterns. It is interesting when you sort of look at some of these movies and what eras they come out in, and then, you know, how they almost do match up against some of the political and cultural anxieties that are going on of the day.
Well, the Cold War, you know, made it easy, I guess. And the drug wars of the 1980s and 90s also supplied a rich market of bad guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And you really see that, you know, the 70s and 80s, you really see this preponderance of, you know, corrupt institutions, urban decay. You know, this is sort of the golden era of the, you know, Hollywood cop drama, right? You know, we're talking about Bullet with Steve McQueen and, you know, Magnum Force and Dirty Harry, and all these movies really feature sort of failing government institutions, corrupt cops.
Who else knew where he was?
What have you been implying?
Well, they knew where to look for him, and they used your name to get in.
Are you suggesting I disclosed his whereabouts?
You believe what you want. You work your side of the street, and I'll work mine.
As the bad guys, you know, drug lords moving in, and yeah, it's really, you know, you can see that sort of borne out in a lot of what was going on in America as well.
And do you have a favorite evil character or evil character genre?
Perhaps because I came of age in sort of the 90s, I do have a fondness for what I like to think of as the sort of generic white guy of that era. Speed, you know, take your pick of any sort of Steven.
So Dennis Hopper, the bomber, right?
Yes, Dennis Hopper, the bomber, and Speed.
There's a bomb on a bus. Once the bus goes 50 miles an hour, the bomb is armed. If it drops below 50, it blows up. What do you do?
Tim Robbins, who is also a generic, you know, the secret bomber next door in the movie Arlington Road.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, there's The Rock with Ed Harris. He's the disgruntled military, you know, honorable military veteran who takes over Alcatraz. And you see this sort of in a lot of movies in the 90s where it's, you know, tends to be sort of this disgruntled white guy or, you know, kind of the bomber next door.
Well, and there are even some movies that actually celebrated the angry white guy almost as the good guy, bad guy as well. You know, I'll tell you, the scariest bad guy for me, bar none, is the old crazy Nazi in Inglourious Basterds, the Quentin Tarantino film. That one is certainly my favorite.
Well, and Christoph Waltz is just, I mean, he's a brilliant actor. You know, he seems to have a really great partnership with Quentin Tarantino. And certainly, you know, his work in Inglourious Basterds, horrifying.
And, you know, the caricature is irresistible. But I guess, you know, ultimately what Hollywood needs are plausible, evil folks who you can see in the world of today. And I guess the only place that's safe right now, for the time being anyway, is North Korea.
You know, it's funny with North Korea because in many ways when they are sort of the villain, and you know, they've been used a few times. You know, one, I think there's, you know, Hollywood's probably not worried about losing the North Korean box office market. You know, I think that's a pretty safe territory for them. You know, and I think in America too, it's interesting that we don't really know much about them, you know, still, even though, you know, we get drips and drips here and there. But, you know, they are sort of this largely unknown nation state, and there's a little anxiety, right, with their nuclear missile ambitions and
more than a little. And you know, Kim Jong-un has yet to be taken down. His father, of course, famously caricatured in Team America.
And God bless Trey Parker and Matt Stone. That's probably one of the underrated gems of the past decade. It's hilarious and just a perfect kind of parody and satire send-up of North Korea as a villain and action movies and Hollywood in general.
James Furbish is the founder of the Sly Oyster blog and co-author of the essay Hollywood's Evil Men, a Symbol of America's Collective Fears. Thanks so much, James.
Thanks for having me on, John.
I'm so lonely, so lonely, so lonely and sad, real alone.
And think about it, folks. The sequel to Team America would have Kim Jong-un and Dennis Rodman in it. I mean, there's a rich stew. Next up, mad scientists, not as bad guys, but mad about declining federal support for basic scientific research. An oceanographer calling on crowdsourced individuals to help fund his research on climate change. We're making our own scientific inquiry into the state of drinking water in America this week. What does the water coming out of your faucet taste like? Aubrey Renfro has good reviews for the water in Bedford, Texas. I really like the tap water here. I trust it. Drink straight from the faucet. Don't do that. You can knock out your teeth. My mother grew up drinking Fort Worth water and says Bedford water is gross and only drinks bottled water. Phil Lindsay in Boston wrote on Facebook, Boston has awesome water. It's better than store-bought. He's going with the Patriots this weekend. But what about spring water right from the well on your property? Misty Jacob says our rural southern Oregon property has a great-tasting well and spring, writes to the most delicious clean water around. I feel very fortunate. But what about Florida?
Hi, this is Janelle. I'm a former New Yorker, now residing in Florida. And no matter what, everything I drink tastes like a swimming pool.
That's not pleasant. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Tell us water stories. Much more at thetakeaway.org. How do scientists get their research money? It's long been the low-hanging fruit for Washington, D.C. spending critics to go after government-funded studies. The U.S. government has spent $175,587 to determine if cocaine makes Japanese quail engage in sexually risky behavior. Sounds like a joke, but it's true. But it's not a joke to the scientists doing the study. And there's also the argument that government and large foundations may have too much influence in funding science. Heather Goldstone, science editor with our partner WGBH and WCAI, has been reporting on new crowdsourcing efforts in scientific funding, using ordinary citizens to even assist in collecting data. The story is about the democratization of science funding. For instance, to get help for his environmental work, scientist Ralph Keeling decided not to fill out another grant application. He appealed directly to people to help him sustain the work of his father, Charles David Keeling,
who began measuring CO2 and oxygen in the atmosphere back in the late 1950s. The Keeling curve is still the standard for that data. Ralph Keeling directs the Scripps carbon dioxide and oxygen programs at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, California. Heather Goldstone and Ralph Keeling both say the crowd numbers are small now, but Keeling, at least, has already seen a lot of fresh new faces excited about his work.
It's actually been a very interesting and rewarding experience so far because it's allowed us to reach out directly to people and communicate what we're doing. And the raising of funding is one part of it, but the direct connection with a community that cares about what we do is probably even more important.
Heather Goldstone, you have a story from Japan, which certainly isn't confined to Japan, which really is all about scientists saying, hey, we need to figure this out, and people stepping up to help.
Absolutely. Dr. Ken Bissler at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has been studying the ocean impacts of the Fukushima nuclear disaster nearly 3 years ago. And it's been difficult to get federal funding for that research all along the way. And so he has now launched a new campaign that I think is a little bit unique in that it's asking citizens to both fund and help conduct research to figure out how much of the radioactivity from Fukushima is hitting the west coast of the U.S. So he's asking interested citizens to contribute funding, obviously, but then also to propose locations that they would like to see monitored for radioactivity in the ocean, and then actually to participate in the research. They've created these kits that they can send to people, basically about a 5-gallon jug that they go out, stick in the ocean, collect a sample of ocean water, and ship that back to Woods Hole to be analyzed by Bissler's lab.
So how does a scientist make a pitch to get people involved? It must be much different than writing a grant.
Well, it absolutely is. And I think in the case of the Fukushima research, they perhaps have an easier pitch than Dr. Keeling has, in that there's a very concerned population on the West Coast who is worried about potential health impacts. And so, you know, this research kind of sells itself in some ways to at least that population who's already very concerned about it.
And so people step up. Does crowdfunding help with all of the expenses of scientific research, or is it simply the same way that grant makers would give a big chunk of cash that then the scientists figure out how to spend?
No, it's really quite different than getting a grant from the federal government. The research institutions that are home to all of this research have all sorts of behind-the-scenes costs, just things like an electricity bill, computer support, things that fall into the category of overhead. And crowdfunding hasn't been used to pay for those things. And actually, Ken Bissler says that he doesn't think they should be.
This is really not the true cost. It'd be about 4 or 5 times higher if they were trying to cover all of this extra cost per sample. And I don't think I can ask or should be asking the public right now anyway to pay for that.
So the federal government, have they dropped the ball here? Is that part of the issue?
That's one way of looking at it. Certainly, funding has gotten tighter. And there's a lot of concern within the scientific community, not only that this is forcing scientists to tighten their belt, but the government funding for basic research, research that does not have any direct application to everyday life yet apparent, that when we cut back on that, that's actually what underpins all of the innovations that turn into new technologies or new medical treatments.
Is there also a drive to maybe look at different kinds of funding models as the federal government moves away from the support that we've seen, you know, a generation ago?
Certainly, we've seen scientists increasingly looking to philanthropic organizations, at this crowdfunding being another possible option. I don't think anyone thinks we should abandon government funding for science. But in addition, the tighter funding has spurred scientists to look at other ways of doing their research that might be more cost effective. One example that I find really exciting and interesting is the research vessel Okeanos Explorer, which is a government operated boat, has for a few years been running virtual research cruises. So this past summer, while they were out in the Atlantic surveying underwater canyons with a remotely operated vehicle, basically a robot that, you know, is being driven by people on the ship and is taking video down on the bottom, some 36 or so labs across the country were connected by a high-speed live feed to that ship and to each other with high-speed communications. And so essentially there were dozens of people watching this feed, participating in the research in real time. That's way more people than you could ever fit on a boat or pay to have on the boat. So for a fraction of the cost, they had all of these people talking to each other, making discoveries that would never have happened on a traditional cruise. And that's according to Dr. Tim Shank of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He says that participating in these cruises over the past few years has completely changed the pace of his research.
We come back normally with all of our data on hard drives, and we'd go through it, and we might send images out to people or talk to people at meetings, and slowly gain, whoa, that was really new. And this now we're doing it while we're in real time, before we even, you know, the cruise is over. So I think it's accelerating the discovery of things in the deep sea, for sure.
Well, you can certainly hear the excitement there in that scientist's voice. Ralph Keeling, are we talking about a democratization of scientific research on some level that you and your colleagues are participating in?
Well, perhaps. It's a new kind of reaching out to a new audience, for sure. A lot of science is funded on the basis of providing new technology or some kind of new exciting discovery. But when it comes to understanding what's happening to the planet, it's really critical that you keep your eyes on what's happening over periods of decades. That's what matters for climate change. I found myself drawn to the measurements of the Earth over the long term because of the pioneering work of my father looking at carbon dioxide concentrations. I've kept that going. Our group also measures concentrations of oxygen, which are decreasing in the atmosphere. And these are giving us really important insights into what's happening with carbon dioxide. It's really the bottom line for the climate problem. And yet, it's not easy to fund this work because it falls a little bit outside the scope of some short-term discovery. You have to keep it going. Most of the science agencies would fund something that's analogous to research, but as soon as you take it into kind of a practice, actually looking at the health of the planet over time, that actually seems to not fit very well. So that's why we're turning to other sources, including private sources and crowdsourcing.
What do you think your dad would say about the response he received?
I'm sure he'd be heartened. I mean, I didn't get into this with any illusions. Doing long-term observations is a challenge, and I do it because I think it's important. It feels more important than other science I could be doing. He felt the same way, and you have to be resourceful to get through these periods.
Heather Goldstone is science editor at WGBH and WCAI in Boston, Massachusetts. Ralph Keeling is director of the Scripps CO2 and O2 programs at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego. Thanks, guys.
You're very welcome.
All day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water, cool water.
So we ask you guys to crowdsource data for us every single day. Tell us what your water supply is like. Stories are different from place to place. Arlington, Texas, best drinking water in the country. Wichita Falls, Texas, my water is scarce and tastes bad. Tell us a story. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
He's the devil, not a man, and he spread the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you?
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.